Side 8, The Boat of a Million Years by Powell Anderson, continuing on page 222. The teepee entrance darkened. A man trod in. While clad like the rest, he bore no war paint, nor was he a native of these lands, but tall, slender, lighter-hued. When he saw who sat with Quanah, he spoke gently in English. "What do you want of me?" 4. They walked over the prairie, Tarrant, Peregrino, Rufus, trailing a step or two behind. Light spilled out of vastness, a measure of warmth lifted from soil. Dry grass rattled. Camp and buildings soon vanished among the tall, tawny stalks. Smokes continued in sight, rising straight and slow toward the vultures. Revelation was strangely subdued. Or perhaps it wasn't strange. They had waited so long. Tarrant and Rufus had felt hope grow into near certainty while they quested. Peregrino had nurtured an inner peace to which any surprise was like a passing breath of air. Thus he endured his loneliness until he outlived it. "I was born almost 3,000 years ago," Tarrant said. "My friend is about half as old." "I never counted time until lately," said Peregrino. They might as well use that name out of the many he had had. "Then I guessed 500 or 600 years." "Before Columbus. What changes you've seen!" Peregrino smiled as a man might at a graveside. "You more. Have you come on any like us, besides Mr. Bullen?" "Not quite. A woman once, but she disappeared. We've no idea whether she's still alive. Otherwise, you're my first since him." "Did you ever?" "No, I tried but gave up. For all I knew, I was solo." "How did you get on my trail?" "That's kind of a story. We got plenty time." "Well..." Tarrant drew a tobacco pouch from his pants, and from his shirt, the briar pipe it would have been unwise to smoke before Quanah. "I'll start with Rufus and me arriving in California in 49. You've heard about the gold rush? We got rich off it, not as miners, as merchants."
"You did, Hanno," said the man at his heel. "I tagged along." "And damn useful you've been in more tight spots than I can list," Tarrant declared. "Eventually I dropped from sight for a few years, then showed up in San Francisco under my present alias and bought a ship. I've always favored the sea. By now I own several. The firm's done right well."
Having loaded his pipe, he laid fire to it. "Whenever I could afford to, I've hired men to look for signs of immortals," he proceeded. "Naturally, I don't tell them that's what they're after. By and large, those of our kind who survive must do it by staying obscure. These days I'm an eccentric millionaire interested in lineages. My agents figure me for an ex-Mormon. They're supposed to locate, individuals who seem much like others that dropped from sight earlier, and are apt to appear carrying a pretty fair grubstake, that sort of thing. But with railroads and steamships, I can at last spread my net across the world. Of course, it's not that big yet, and the mesh is awfully coarse, which may be why it's caught nothing except a few that turned out false."
"Until today," said Peregrino.
Tarrant nodded. "A scout of mine, exploring around Santa Fe, caught rumors about a medicine man among the Comanches who didn't really belong to them. The description sounded like a Sioux or a Pawnee or whatever, but he'd gained a good deal of authority and... he'd been heard of elsewhere, earlier, several different times and places. Not that any civilized person had pieced this together. Who take the fancies of savages seriously? Pardon me, no offense. You know how whites think. My agent didn't suppose it was worth pursuing. He noted it in a couple of sentences in his report, just to show me how industrious he was. That was last year. I decided to follow it up myself. Lucked out and found two aged people, an Indian and a Mexican, who remembered, well, it seemed if he existed, he'd joined Quanah. I hoped to find the Comanches in winter quarters, but as was, we had to track them."
Tarrant laid a hand briefly on Peregrino's shoulder. "And here we are, my brother."
Peregrino halted. Tarrant did. For a space they looked into each other's eyes. Rufus stood aside, bemused. At last Tarrant formed a wry grin and murmured, "You're wondering whether I'm a liar, aren't you?"
"How do you know I speak truth?" the Indian replied, as low.
"Tactful fellow, you. Well, in the course of time, I've cached evidence, as well as getaway gold, here and there. Come with me, and I'll show you enough of it. Or you can simply watch me for 20 or 30 years. I'll provide for you. Meanwhile, why else on earth should I spin you a yarn like this?"
Peregrino nodded.
"I believe you. But how do you know I'm not out to swindle you?"
"You couldn't have foreseen my arrival, and you did leave many years' worth of trail. Not on purpose. No white who didn't know what to look for would ever have suspected. The tribes, what do they make of you anyway?"
"That depends."
Peregrino's gaze went over miles where grass waved above buffalo skulls, on beyond the horizon. When he spoke slowly, often stopping to form a sentence before he uttered it, his English became a language other than what he had been using.
"Each lives in its own world, you know, and those worlds are changing so fast. At first I was a medicine man among my birth people, but they took to the horse and everything that went with that. I left them and drifted for winter after winter, summer after summer. I was trying to find what it meant, all that I lived through. Sometimes I settled down a while, but it always hurt too much, seeing what was happening. I even tried the whites. At a mission I got baptized, learned Spanish and English, reading and writing. Afterward I went deep into Mexican and Anglo country both. I have been a market hunter, trapper, carpenter, wrangler, gardener. I talked with everybody who would talk with me, and read every printed word that came my way. But that was no good either. I never belonged there. Meanwhile, tribe after tribe got wiped out by sickness, by war, or broken and herded onto a reservation. Then if the whites decided they wanted that land too, out the redskins went. I saw the Cherokees at the end of their Trail of Tears." The quiet, almost matter-of-fact voice died away. Rufus cleared his throat.
"Well, that's how the world is," he grated. "I seen Saxons, Vikings, Crusaders, Turks, wars of religion, witches burned."
"Louder.
I seen what Injuns do when they get the upper hand."
Tarrant frowned him to silence and asked Peregrino, "What brought you here?" The other sighed.
"I finally thought, oh, I was slow about it. This life of mine that went on and on and on, with nothing to show for it but graves, it must have some purpose, some use. And maybe that was just in the long experience, and being ageless would make folks listen to me. Maybe I could help my people, my whole race, before they went under, help them save something for a new beginning. About 30 years ago I came back to them. The Southwest was where free tribes were likely to hang on the longest. The Nermernu, you do know Comanche is from Spanish, don't you? They had driven out the Apaches. They had fought the Kiowas as equals and made allies of them. For 300 years they had stood off the Spanish, the French, the Mexicans, the Texans, and carried war to the enemy in his home country. Now the Americans aim to crush them once for all. They've earned better than that, haven't they?"
"What are you doing?"
Tarrant's question seemed to hover like the dark wings overhead. "To tell the truth, I was among the Kiowas first," Peregrino said. "They are more open in their minds than the Nermernu, also about long life. Comanches believe a real man dies young, in battle or the hunt, while he is strong. They don't trust their old ones and treat them bad. Not like my birth people, so long ago. I let my reputation grow with time. It helped that I know some things to do for the wounded and the sick. I never set myself up as a prophet. Those crazy preachers have been the death of thousands, and the end is not yet. No, I just went around from band to band, and they came to think I was holy. I did whatever I could for them in the way of healing or advice. Always I counseled peace. Finally, it's a long story.
I joined up with Quanah because he was becoming the last great chief. Everything will turn on him.
Peace, did you say?
And whatever we can save for our children. The Comanches have nothing left from their ancestors, nothing they can truly believe in. That eats them out from the inside. It leaves them wide open for the likes of Owl Prophet. I found a new faith among the Kiowas, and I'm bringing it to the Nermernu.
Do you know the peyote cactus? It opens a way. It quiets the heart.
Peregrino stopped. A tiny laugh fluttered in his throat.
Well, I don't mean to sound like a missionary.
I'll be glad to listen later, said Tarrant, while he thought, I have seen so many gods come and go, what's one more?
Also, to any ideas you may have about making peace. I told you I have money, and I've always made a point of getting wires in my hands. You savvy? Certain politicians owe me favors. I can buy others. We'll work out a plan, you and I, but first, we've got to get you away from here, back to San Francisco with us, before you take a bullet in your brain. Why the hell did you come along with these raiders, anyway?
I said I have to make them listen to me, Peregrino explained wearily. It's uphill work. They're suspicious of old men to start with, and when their world is falling to pieces around them, they're afraid of magic as strange as mine, and they've got to understand I'm not unmanly. I am on their side. I can't leave them now.
Wait a minute, Rufus barked.
They stared at him. He stood four square, legs planted wide apart, hat pushed back from roughened red face. The hook that had pierced Foeman looked suddenly frail under this heaven.
Wait a minute, stumbled from him. Boss, what are you thinking? The first thing we got to do is save those ranchers.
Parent moistened his lips before it dragged out of him.
We can't. We're 2 against 100 or worse, unless...
He cast a glance at Peregrino. The Indian shook his head.
In this the people would not heed me, he told them, dull-voiced. I would only lose what standing I have. I mean, can we ransom that family? Comanches often sell prisoners back, I've heard. I've brought trade goods along, besides what was intended for presents, and Herrera ought to turn his stock over to me if I promise him payment in gold.
Peregrino grew thoughtful.
Well, maybe. That's giving those devils the stuff to kill more white, Rufus protested.
Bitterness sharpened Peregrino's tone.
You were telling us how this sort of thing is nothing new on earth. But the barbarians in Europe, they were white. Even the Turks. Oh, you don't mind. You ride with these animals. That'll do, Rufus,
Tarrant clipped.
Remember why we've come. Saving a few who'll be dead anyway inside a century is not our business.
I'll see if I can, but Peregrino here is our real kinsman.
So pipe down.
His comrade whirled about and stalked off. Tarrant watched him go.
He'll get over it, he said, short-tempered and not very bright, but he's been loyal to me since before the fall of Rome.
Why does he care about dayflies? The medicine man wondered. Tarrant's pipe had gone out. He rekindled it and stared into the smoke as it lost itself beneath the sky.
Immortals get influenced by their surroundings, too, he said. We've mostly lived in the New World these past 200 years, Rufus and I. First Canada, when it was French. But then we moved to the English colonies. More freedom, more opportunity, if you were English yourself, as of course we claimed to be. Later we were Americans. Same thing. It affected him more than me. I owned slaves now and then, and shares in a couple of plantations, but didn't think much about it either way. I'd always taken slavery for granted, and it was a misfortune that could happen to anybody, regardless of race. When the war between the states ended it, and a great deal else, to me that was simply another spin in history's wheel. As a shipowner in San Francisco, I didn't need slaves. But Rufus, he's a primitive soul. He wants something to cling to, which is what immortals never can have, right? He's gone through a dozen Christian faiths. Last time he got converted was at a Baptist revival,
and a lot of it still clings to him. Both before and after the war, he took seriously what he kept hearing about the white race's right and duty to lord it over the colored. Tarrant chuckled unmerrily. Besides, he's been without a woman since we left Santa Fe. It was a terrible disappointment to him when he found on the staked plains that Comanche women don't free and easy receive outsiders like they do, or used to do, farther north. There must be a white woman or two in yonder cabin. He doesn't imagine he lusts after them himself. Oh, he wouldn't dream of anything except being respectful and gallant and getting adoring looks. But the thought of redskin after redskin on them seems to be more than he can bear.
He may have to, Peregrino said.
Yes, he may, Tarrant grimaced.
I must admit I don't relish it, nor the idea of ransoming them with guns. I'm not quite as case-hardened as I must behave. I think nothing will happen for hours.
Good.
I have to give Quanah my presence, go through any formalities. You'll advise me, won't you? But not right away, hmm? Let's walk on. We've a lot of talking to do, you and me. 3,000 years worth.
5.
Warriors gathered around. Now they were still, in wildcat dignity, for this was a ceremonial occasion. The westering sun cast gleams over obsidian hair and mahogany skin. On the eastern side it lit flames in eyes. Between the ranks, before his teepee, Quanah received Tarrant's gifts. He made a speech in his father's language, lengthy, and doubtless full of imagery in his father's wise. Standing by the visitor, Peregrino said in English when it was done, "He thanks you. He calls you friend. And tomorrow morning you will pick out of his horses whichever you like best. That is generous for a man on the warpath."
"I know," Tarrant said.
To Quanah in Spanish, "My thanks to you, great chief. May I ask a favor, in the name of the friendship you so kindly give us?"
Herrera, in the front row, though well back, started, tautened, and squinted.
Tarrant hadn't stopped by him upon returning, but had collected his presence and gone straight here. Word flew quickly about, and when he saw the braves assemble, Herrera came for politeness and wariness.
"You may ask," said Quanah, impassive.
"I wish to buy free those folks you hold trapped. They are useless to you. Why should you spend more time and men on them? We will take them away with us. In exchange, we will pay a good price."
A stir went through the Comanches, a rustle, a buzz. Those who understood whispered to those who had not. Hands tightened on hats, here and there on a firearm.
A man near the chief uttered a string of harsh words. He was gaunt, scarred, more deeply lined in the face than was common even for aged Indians. Others near him muttered as if in agreement. Quanah lifted a hand for attention and told Tarrant,
"Waha'oma says we have our fallen to avenge." "They fell, honorably."
"He means all our fallen, through all the years and lifetimes, death times, we have suffered."
"I didn't think you people thought that way."
"Waha'oma was a boy in that camp where the Tejanos took Quanah's mother," Peregrino related. "He found cover and escaped, but they shot down his own mother, brother, two little sisters. A while back he lost his wife and a small son. The soldiers were using a howitzer. The same has happened, different places, to many who are here."
"I'm sorry," Tarrant said to any who would listen. "But those people yonder had nothing to do with that, and, well, I carry plenty of fine things like those I've given your chief. Wouldn't you rather have them than a few stinking scalps?"
Waha'oma claimed the right to speak. He went on for minutes, snarling, hissing, flinging up his hands and crying aloud to heaven. Anger answered in a surf noise. When he was done and had folded his arms, Peregrino scarcely needed to translate. "He calls this an insult. Shall the Nermenos sell their victory for blankets and booze? They'll take more loot than they can carry off the Tejanos, and the scalps as well."
He had warned Tarrant to expect this kind of outcome. Therefore Tarrant looked straight at Quanah and said, "I can make a better offer. We have rifles with us,
boxes full of cartridges, things you need as you need horses if you are to wage war. How much for those poor lives?"
Herrera took a step forward.
"No, wait," he called.
Quanah forestalled him.
"Are these in your baggage? If so, good. If not, you are too late. Your companion has already agreed to trade his for cattle."
Parent stood moveless.
Wahaumaw, who must have gotten the gist, crowed at him. "I could have told you," Herrera said through the rising crowd noise.
Quanah brought that down while Peregrino breathed in Tarrant's ear. "I will see whether I can talk them into changing the deal.
Keep your hopes on a tight rein, though."
He launched into oratory. His fellows responded likewise. For the most part, they spoke soberly. The effort always was to reach a consensus. They had no government. Civil chiefs were little more than judges, mediators, and even war chiefs only commanded in battle.
Quanah waited out the debate. Toward the end, Herrera had something to say.
Soon after that, Quanah pronounced what he took to be the verdict, and assent passed among his followers like an ebb-tide wave. The sun stood low. Wahaumaw cast Tarrant a triumphant glare. Sadness dulled Peregrino's English. "You have guessed, no. It did not work. They have not gotten much blood yet, and are thirsty for it. Wahaumaw claimed it would be bad luck to give quarter, and quite a few were ready to believe that. They can spare the half a dozen to round up this ranch's herd and bring it to New Mexico. They enjoy that trip. And the Comanchero told them he is not a man to pull out of a bargain once it's been struck. That made them extra touchy about their own honor. Also, Quanah didn't argue either way, but they know he has an idea for taking the house that he would like to try, and they are curious what it may be."
He stood silent for part of a minute.
"I did my best. I really did."
"Of course," Tarrant answered.
"Thanks.
I want you to know I don't like what will happen, either. Let's ride off and not come back till morning, you and me. Rufus, if he wants."
Tarrant shook his head.
"I've a notion I'd better stay around. Don't worry. I've seen enough sacks in the past."
"I suppose you have," said Peregrino.
The meeting broke up. Tarrant gave Quanah his respects and walked among knots of warriors, whose looks on him ranged from sullen to gleeful, toward Herrera's camp. It was several yards from the nearest teepee. The New Mexican found men to talk with and thus delayed himself. His sons had a fire started. They were busy with preparations for supper before the quick prairie dark should fall. Long sunbeams trailed through smoke. Bedrolls waited. Rufus sat idle, hunched, a bottle in his single fist. He looked up when Tarrant approached and asked, needlessly, once he had seen, "What happened?"
"No dice."
Tarrant lowered himself to the trampled grass and reached out.
"I'll take a swig of that whiskey. Not much, and you'd better watch it closer."
Its bite went beneficent down his gullet.
"I've failed altogether. Peregrino won't leave the Comanches, and they won't take ransom."
Curtly he described the situation.
"That son of a bitch,"
Rufus breathed.
"Who? Quanah? He may be enemy, but he's honest."
"No, Herrera. He could have—"
The trader glided into view.
"Did I hear my name?"
he asked.
"Yeah."
Rufus lurched to his feet, bottle in hand. He stayed with English except for,
"Thee para es. You snake. You greaser. You could have sold Hanno. Sold the boss those guns and—"
Herrera's right hand moved toward his coat. His sons edged left and right, not yet drawing their knives.
"I could not change a bargain that had been made," he said.
Spanish was too soft a language to convey the full coldness.
"Not unless they agreed, and they refused. That would have hurt my reputation, damaged my business." "Sure, you breed. You're always ready for selling white men, white women, selling them for money. Blood money."
Rufus spat at Herrera's feet.
"We will not speak of blood," said the trader most quietly. "I know who my father was. and I saw him weep when the Yankees robbed our country from us. Now I must step aside for them in the streets of Santa Fe. The priest tells me I should not hate them, but need I care what becomes of them?"
Rufus groaned. His hook slashed. Herrera slipped back in time. The pistol sprang forth. Tarrant jumped to his feet and caught Rufus by the arms before the Redbeard could try to draw. Slowly, the boys sheathed their blades.
"Behave yourself," Tarrant panted. "Sit down." "Not with these,"
Rufus coughed in Latin. He shook free of the grasp on him.
"And you, Hanno, can't you remember?
Like that woman we saved way back when in Russia. And that was just a single man, and he wouldn't have cut her belly open afterward or given her to the females with their knives and torches." He stumbled off, away from everybody, still gripping the bottle. Looks followed him for a little. Then Tarrant said to Herrera, "Let him be. He'll get his wits back. Thanks for your patience." With less than total sincerity. 6. Twice during the afternoon, Tom Langford ventured outside. When he saw the encampment, he stepped quickly in again and rebarred the door. Toward evening, he said,
"I expect they'll try a night attack. Why else would they hang around this long? Maybe again at dawn, but could be any time. We'll just have to keep alert. If we stand them off then, they ought to up and go. Injuns don't know how to lay a siege."
Bill Davis laughed softly and richly. "We ain't worth it," he opined.
"Los vecinos vendrán indudablemente a ayudarnos."
"Help will come,"
Carlos Padilla ventured.
"I don't know how fast, if ever," Langford sighed. "Supposing Bob got through. The neighbors are scattered pretty thin these days. Maybe a cavalry troop is somewhere close enough."
"We are in the hands of God," Susie declared. She smiled at her husband. "Yours too, dear. And strong hands they are." Ed Lee tossed and muttered on the Langford's bed. His injury had lit a fever in him. The children were more than ready for sleep. First there was supper, cold beans, bread, the last milk. They had no firewood to speak of and little water. Langford asked his wife to say grace. Nobody minded when Carlos crossed himself. Afterward, the men, one by one, and bashfully, went behind a sort of curtain Susie had rigged in a corner to hide the bucket all must share. Langford had emptied it whenever he stepped out. He hoped nobody more would have any real business there till the Indians were gone. That would be kind of nasty, in these close quarters, with a woman and a girl. The privy was sod. It ought to be around yet. If not, well, they'd have the tall grass for walls, the freedom of these acres for which he had saved and toiled, and now fought. Dusk thickened to night. A single candle burned on the table amidst the guns. The Langfords and the Hale men stood watches, two peering out loopholes taken in turn, while two caught naps on the floor or alongside poor Ed. Stars crowded what they glimpsed of sky. The ground was gray-black, vague. A waning sliver of moon would be scant help when it rose shortly before the sun. Meanwhile, the cold and the stillness gnawed away. Once the wife whispered from her side of the room, "Tom?"
"Yeah?"
He allowed himself a look at her. In this dim light, he couldn't see dirt, exhaustion, hollow cheeks, and black-rimmed eyes. She was the girl of his courting days, from whose front porch he'd walk home on the rainbow. "Tom, if they do get in and you have the chance—" She must take a breath. "Would you shoot me first?"
"Christ, no,"
he choked and could taste the horror. "Please, I'd bless you. You might live, honey. They do sell prisoners to our people." She stared at the floor, then quickly, remembering her duty, out a loophole. "I wouldn't want to live. Not after. Do you suppose I'd ever turn my back on you? Reckon you don't know me as well as I thought."
"No, but you—"
"I'd be without you on earth. Why not together in heaven at once?" He knew the Redskins wouldn't spare his life. Unless he was lucky, he wouldn't be a man when he died. Not that knives and fire, or being staked out under the sun with his eyelids cut off, would leave him in shape to think much about that. Well, you might still manage to get the kids through. Again her head drooped. Yes, I'm sorry. I clean forgot. Yes, I was being selfish.
Aw, don't you fret, sweetheart, he said as cheerfully as he was able. Nothing bad's going to happen. Next week our biggest worry will be how we can keep from bragging too loud.
Thank you, darling. She turned her attention outward. The night wore on. They had divided it into four watches, then all to be afoot in advance of dawn, when attack was likeliest. About 3 in the morning, by the grandfather clock, the Langfords finished their second trick, roused the hands, and stretched themselves out, he on the floor, she beside Ed. Should the hurt man stir from the heavy sleep into which he had dropped, she'd know it and see to whatever need was his. The other men would shoot better, the more well-rested they were. A shotgun blast kicked Langford awake. Bill thudded against the wall and fell. The lead had sleeted across the cabin and taken him in the back. By candlelight and monstrous flickery shadows, the blood that gushed from him shone blacker than his skin. Carlos crouched on the north side, rifle aimed and useless. 2 broad muzzles thrust in by the west loopholes. 1 smoked. It withdrew. Instantly another took its place. Meanwhile, the second roared. Langford jumped to the bedside, and Susie, sick understanding, billowed through him. Hostiles, just 3 or 4, had crawled under cover of night, slowly, often stopping, shadows in the gloom, till they were among the stakes and under the eaves. When they shoved their guns through, maybe they hoped they'd fire straight into an eye. No matter. Shooting blind, wedging the barrels to and fro, they made defense impossible. Hoops lifted, nearer and nearer. Thunder beat on the door. No tomahawks, Langford knew. That was a regular woodcutting axe, probably his. Panels splintered. A gust blew out the candle. Langford fired and fired, but he couldn't see anything for sure. The hammer clicked on emptiness. Where the hell were the loaded guns? Susie screamed. Maybe he should have saved a bullet for her. Too late. The door was down and the dark full of warriors. 7. The racket brought Tarrant and the Herreras from their bedrolls, hands to weapons. Tumult went murky among the teepees. El ataque, the trader said beneath yells and shouts. What are they doing? Tarrant grated. Another frontal assault in the dead of night? Crazy. I do not know, Herrera said. The noise rose rapidly to crescendo. He bared teeth, a dim flash under the stars. Victory! They are taking the house. Tarrant bent to put on his boots. Where do you go? Stay here! You could too easily get killed. I've got to see if I can do anything. You cannot! Myself, I stay, not out of fear, but because I do not want to see what comes next. Tarrant's pain lashed. You told me you don't care. Not much, Herrera admitted. But it would be evil to gloat, nor have I the heart for it. No, my sons and I will pray for them. He plucked the other man's sleeve. You slept fully clad in such a place as this. Do stay. You, somehow, I like. I'll be careful, Tarrant promised, and loped off. He skirted the Comanche camp. More and more torches came to life there, flared, bobbed, streamed sparks on their hasty way. Sight of them dimmed the stars that, in their uncountable thousands, gleamed frost-bright across black. Nevertheless, he had light enough to turn the soil gray for him. Where the devil was Rufus? Probably snoring out on the prairie alongside the empty bottle. Just as well. No matter how self-controlled, a white man took a risk showing himself to red men in blood rut. So why did he, Hanno, Lugo, Cadog, Jacques Lacey, William Sawyer, Jack Tarrant, 100 different aliases, behave like this? He knew he couldn't save the ranchers, and didn't mean to try. They must perish as star many had perished before them and would in the future, over and over, world without end. History chewed them up and spat them out, and soon, most rotted, forgotten, might as well never have been. Maybe the Christians were right, and mankind was like that. Maybe it was simply in the nature of things. His intention was practical. He hadn't survived this long by hiding from the terrible. Rather, he kept alert, aware, so he'd know which way to jump when the sword swung. Tonight he'd observe from the fringes. If an impulse arose to wipe out his party, too, he could talk it down, given help from Peregrino and maybe even Quanah before it got out of control. In the morning he'd start back toward Santa Fe. The chief stood huge near the cabin, a long-held axe on his shoulder, torchlight guttered across painted face and body, horned headdress. It was as if he flickered in and out of hell. The braves were mostly less clear, blobs of night that swarmed, pranced, screeched, waved their brands like battle flags. Squaws capered with him, knives or sharpened sticks in hand. The doorway gaped hollow. They kept clear a space in front of it. Three dead men sprawled at the threshold, dragged forth. The Anglo's left arm was splinted. Someone had cut his throat before stopping to think about sport. Rib ends stuck out of a hole torn in the Negro's back. The third seemed Mexican, though he was so slashed and pulped it was hard to be sure. He had gone down fighting. Lucky bastards. Two squaws held fast a small boy and a smaller girl who screamed, blind with fear. A tall Anglo sat slumped. Blood matted his hair and dripped onto clothes and earth. He was stunned. Two warriors locked the arms of a young woman who writhed, kicked, cursed them, and called on her god. A man bounded from the ruck. A torch swung near him for a moment, and Tarrant recognized Waha'amaw. He had slung his rifle to free his hands. The right gripped a knife. He laughed aloud, caught the color of the woman's dress in his left, slashed downward. The cloth parted, whiteness gleamed, and a sudden string of blood beads. Her captors forced her down on her back. Waha'amaw fumbled at his breech clout. The man prisoner stirred, croaked, struggled to regain his feet. A brave gave him a gun butt in the stomach, and he sagged, retching. A grizzly bear growl resounded. From around the cabin stormed Rufus. His coat was drawn. He swept his hook back and forth. Two Indians stumbled aside, faces gashed open. He reached the woman. The men who pinned her sprang up. He shot one through the forehead. He hooked an eye from the other, who recoiled, shrieking. His boots smashed into Waha'amaw's groin. That warrior tumbled to squirm by the white man. He sought to choke down agony, but it jerked past his lips. Flambeau flare made Rufus' beard its own hue. He stood with his legs on either side of the woman, hunched forward, swaying a little, flaming drunk, but the colt rock steady before him. "All right," he boomed. "You filthy swine, first of you makes a move, I'll plug him. She's gonna go free, and—" Waha'amaw straightened on the ground and rolled over. Rufus didn't see. There was too much else for him to watch. "Look out!" Tarrant heard himself yell. The Indian howls drowned his voice. Waha'amaw unslung his rifle. Prone, he fired. Rufus lurched back. The pistol fell. Waha'amaw shot again. Rufus crumpled. His weight sank onto the woman and held her fast. Wild, Tarrant shoved men aside. He sprang into the clear space and went on his knees beside Rufus. "O sodalis amici perennis!" Blood bubbled from the mouth and into the red beard. Rufus gasped. For an instant it seemed he grinned, but Tarrant couldn't really know in the shifty torchlight or even by the light of the stars. He clasped the big body to him and felt life ebb away. Only then did he hear what a silence had fallen. He looked aloft. Quanah stood above him, the axe held out like a roof or a buffalo hide shield. Had he roared his folk into quietude? They were a massive blur, well back from him and the dead, the wounded, the captive. Here and there a blaze briefly picked out a face or made eyeballs glisten. Tarrant hauled Rufus off the woman. She stirred, stared, mewed. "Easy," he murmured. She got to hands and knees, made her way thus to the man. Squaws had let go of the children who were already at his side. He'd regained consciousness. At least he could sit straight and lay his arms around them all. The warriors Rufus injured had joined the crowd except for the slain one and Waha'amaw. He had risen but leaned on his rifle, shakily, holding himself where the pain was. Tarrant got up, too. Quanah lowered his axe. The pair of them regarded each other. "Bad is this," said the chief at last. Very bad. A skipper from Phoenicia learned how to snatch at every chance, no matter how thin a shred.
Yes, Tarrant answered. A man of yours has killed a guest of yours.
He, your man, broke murdering into our midst. He had a right to speak, to be heard in your council. When your Nermernu would bar his way and likely attack him, he acted in self-defense. He was under your protection, Quanah. At worst, you could have had him seized from behind as many men as you command. I think you would have done that if you had gotten the chance, for everyone calls you a man of honor. But this creature shot him first.
Wahaamaw groaned outrage. Tarrant didn't know how much he had understood. The argument was weak, almost ridiculous. Quanah could dismiss it out of hand, and yet... Peregrino stepped forth. He overtopped the chief by a couple of inches. He carried a medicine bundle and a wand on which hung three buffalo tails, things he must have brought from his teepee. A hiss and mumble went through the crowd. Torches wavered.
Detsanoye, the Undying One, had power to raise awe in the fiercest heart.
Stay where you are, Jack Tarrant, he said quietly, while Quanah and I go talk.
The chief nodded. He spoke certain commands. Wahaamaw snarled, but hobbled obediently off to lose himself in the throng. Several warriors came, rifles in hand, to keep guard on the whites. Quanah and Peregrino departed into the night. Tarrant went over to the prisoners and hunkered down.
Listen, he said low. We may be able to get you free. Keep still, don't make any fuss. This band's had a shock that cooled them down some, but don't do anything to remind them they meant to destroy you.
I got you,
the man answered, clearly if not quite firmly yet.
Whatever happens, we owe you our prayers, you and your partner.
He came like a knight of King Arthur, the woman whispered. He came like a goddamned drunken idiot, Tarrant thought. I could have headed him off if I'd known. I would have. Oh, Rufus, old buddy, you always hated to be alone, and now you are, forever.
The man offered his hand. Tom Langford, he said. My wife Susan, Nancy, Jimmy, James.
For out of grime and drying tears and the start of a bruise, the boy had cast his father a reproachful look. Tarrant wanted to hoot laughter. He choked it down, shook hands, gave his name, and finished.
We'd better not talk more. Besides, the Indians expect me to see to my dead.
Rufus lay about 10 feet from the Langfords. It might have been 10,000 miles. Tarrant couldn't wash him, but he straightened the body, closed the eyes, bound up the jaw with a bandana. He drew his pocket knife and cut himself in the face and the long bared arms and chest. Blood welled and dripped. Nothing serious, but it impressed the watchers. This was their way of mourning, not the white man's. Surely, therefore, the dead was mightily important to be avenged with cannon and saber unless his friends were appeased. At the same time, the friend who was here did not wail over him, and that, too, was eerie. By ones and twos and threes, the Nermernu melted off toward the comfort of their camp.
Well, Rufus, you did have 1,500 years, and you enjoyed just about every day of them. You wenched and fought and sang and gorged and swilled and adventured. You were a hard worker when we needed work done, and a better yet man to have at my back when we needed that, and in your rough, rough style a pretty good husband and father whenever we settled down a while. I could have done without your stupid practical jokes. And by ourselves for any length of time your conversation got so boring it was physically painful. And if you saved my life now and then, I staked my own as often to pull you out of some scrape you'd blundered into, and a lot of gusto went out of my world tonight, Rufus. A lot of love.
False dawn chilled the east. Quanah and Peregrino were dim in sight until they reached the cabin and halted. Tarrant rose. The guards glided deferentially aside. From the ground, the Langfords stared dull-eyed, wrung dry. their children uneasily asleep. Parent stood waiting.
"It is decided," said Quanah.
The deep voice rolled like hoofs over the plains. Breath blew ghost white in the cold.
"Let all men know that the Nermerno are generous. They will heed my wishes in this matter. You, the trader, and his sons may go home. You may take these captives along. They are in exchange for your comrade. He brought his death on himself, but since he was a guest, let that be his price, because the Nermerno set high their honor. Nor shall his body be harmed, but we will give him decent burial so that his spirit may find its way to the afterworld. I have spoken."
A shudder passed below Tarrant's skin. He had more than half awaited worse than this. Somehow he kept it hidden and said,
"I thank you much, senor, and I will tell my people that the soul of Quanah is large."
He believed he meant it. For an instant the chief let his stateliness drop.
"Thank Peregrino. He persuaded me. Begone before sunrise."
He beckoned to the guards. They followed him toward the Comanche camp. A mortal might have crumbled to pieces as the pressure came off, cackled and gibbered and swooned. An immortal had more reserves, more bounce. Nonetheless, Tarrant's words trembled.
"How did you do it, Peregrino?" "I pushed your argument as far as it would go."
Again the Indian took time to build and weigh each English sentence. "He wasn't unwilling to take it. He isn't a fiend, you know. He's fighting for the life of his people. But he must convince them also. I had to call in all my chips, call on the spirits, finally tell him that either he released you or I left him. He does value my advice as well as my medicine." After that, it wasn't hard to get him to release this family, too. "I will help him convince the warriors that was a good idea."
"He was right when he told me to thank you," Tarrant said. "I will for as many centuries as I've got left."
Peregrino's smile was as bleak as the eastern light. "You need not. I had my reasons, and I want my price." Tarrant swallowed. "What is it?" The tone mildened.
"I admit I did have to save you. Maybe you and I are the only immortals in the world now. We must join together sometime. But meanwhile..."
Peregrino reached out and caught Tarrant's arm.
"Meanwhile, here are my people," throbbed from him. "I wasn't born to them, but they are almost the last of us who were born to this land and are still free. They won't be much longer. Soon they will be broken. Even as Tyre and Carthage were, Gallia and Britannia, Rome and Byzantium, Albigensians and Hussites, Basques and Irish, Quebec and the Confederacy. I told you yesterday out on the prairie, I have to stay with them to the end, reason with them, help them find a new faith and hope. Else they'll dash themselves to pieces like buffalo over a cliff. So I will be working among them for peace. I want you to do the same. As I told Quanah, letting these few go can earn us a little goodwill. More will die horribly. But here is a talking point for you. You claim you are rich and have the ear of powerful men. All right. My price for these lives is that you work on your side for peace. A peace that my people can live with." "I'll try my best," said Tarrant.
He truly meant that. If nothing else, the day would come when Peregrino held him to account. They clasped hands. The Indian strode off. False dawn died away, and he was quickly into the shadows.
"Follow me,"
Tarrant called to the Langfords. "We have to hit the trail at once." What sum of years had Rufus bought for these four? 200, maybe? 8. In far western eyes, the Wichita Mountains were hardly more than hills, but they rose steeply, treeless, yet under the spring rains turning deeply green and starred with wildflowers. In its valley among them, a big house and its outbuildings reigned over many acres of cropland, pasture, cattle, and horses. Horses! Grass shone wet after a shower, and clouds drifted white, when a hired carriage left the main road for the drive to the homestead. A farmhand on a pony, who had been inspecting fences, saw it, and rode to inquire. Mr. Parker wasn't here, he said. The driver, who was likewise an Indian, explained that his passenger's business was actually with Mr. Peregrino. Startled, the worker gave directions and stared after the vehicle. It was almost as strange to him as the autos that occasionally stuttered by. A side track brought it to a frame cabin surrounded by flower beds, kitchen garden in back. On the porch a man clad in dungarees and sandals sat reading. He wore his hair in braids, but was too tall and slender to be a Comanche. As the carriage approached, he laid his book aside, sprang down the steps, and stood waiting. It stopped. A white man climbed out. His clothes bespoke prosperity, only if you looked closely at material and tailoring. For a moment he and the dweller were still. Then they ran to grip hands and look into each other's eyes. "At last!" Peregrino said, not quite evenly. "Bienvenido, amigo." "I'm sorry to have been this long about coming," Tarrant answered. "It happened I was in the Orient on business when your letter reached San Francisco. After I got home, I thought a telegram might draw too much notice. You'd written to me years ago, when I sent you my address, that just that bit of mail set tongues wagging. So I simply caught the first train east." "It's all right. Come in, come in." With long practice behind it, the English flowed easily, colloquially. "If your driver wants, he can go on to the big house. They'll take care of him. He can cart us to town. How about day after tomorrow? I've things of my own to see to, including stuff I'd like shipped after me, if that's okay with you." "Of course, Peregrino. Damn near anything you may want is." Having spoken to the other man, Tarrant took a Gladstone bag from the carriage and accompanied his host inside. The cabin held four rooms, neat, clean, sunny, austerely furnished except for a substantial number of books, a gramophone, a collection of mostly classical records, and in the bedchamber certain articles of religion. "You'll sleep here," Peregrino said. "I'll roll up in the backyard. No, not a peep out of you. You're my guest. Besides, it'll be kind of like old days. I often do it anyway, in fact." Tarrant glanced around. "You live alone, then?" "Yes. It seemed wrong to me getting married and having kids when I knew that in the end I'd fake something and desert them. Life among the free tribes was different. How about you?" Tarrant's mouth pinched together. "My latest wife died last year. Young. Consumption. We tried a desert climate, everything, but, well, we had no children, and this identity has been around nearly as long as is safe. I'm making ready for a change." They settled themselves in the front room on wooden chairs. Above Peregrino's head, a chromolithograph gazed from its frame at Tarrant, a Rembrandt self-portrait. Bad though the copy was, mortal sorrow lingered in those eyes. From his bag, Tarrant had taken a bottle of scotch. Illegally, he filled both glasses his host had fetched. He also offered Havana cigars. Mere creature comforts are still comforts. "How have you been doing otherwise?" Peregrino inquired. "Busy," Tarrant said. "Not sure how rich I am. I'd have to go through the books of several aliases. But it's a heap, and bigger every day. One thing I want you for, besides yourself, is to help me think what's most worth spending it on. How about you?" "Peaceful, on the whole. I cultivate my patch of land, make things in my woodworking shop, counsel my congregation, native church, so I'm not really like a white minister, and teach in a school. I'll be sorry to leave that. Oh, and I read a lot, trying to learn about your world. And I suppose you're Kwana's advisor." "Well, yes. But look, don't think I'm the power behind his sad little throne or anything like that. He's done it all himself. He's a remarkable man. Among whites, he'd have been a Lincoln or Napoleon. The most I can claim credit for is making some things possible, or at least easier, for him.
He went ahead and did them.
Tarrant nodded, remembering. The Grand Alliance of Comanche, Kiowa, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, Quanah, its paramount chief, the bloody repulse at Adobe Walls, the year of warfare and manhunt that followed, and the last starvelings, led by Quanah, going on to the reservation in 1875. The good intentions of an Indian agent 3 years afterward, when he arranged for the Comanches to ride out under military escort on a final buffalo hunt. And no buffalo remained. And yet... "Where is he now?" Tarrant asked.
"In Washington," Peregrino said, receiving a look of surprise.
"He goes there fairly often. He is our spokesman for all our tribes. And, well, too bad about Mr. McKinley. But that did put Theodore Roosevelt in the White House. He and Quanah know each other. They're friends."
He smoked for a while in silence. The ageless are seldom hurried. At length he went on.
"Among us, Quanah's more than a rather wealthy farmer. He's a headman and judge. He holds us together. The whites don't like the peyote, nor his clutch of wives, but they put up with it because he doesn't just keep us going. By doing so, he keeps their consciences at ease. Not that he's any sober sides. A genial sort, apt to tell stories or use language that'd make a sailor blush. But he is reconciliation. He calls himself Quanah Parker, in memory of his mother. Lately he talks about having her bones and his sister's moved here so they can rest beside his. Oh, I don't blinker myself. We Indians have a steep, tough road to walk, and a lot of us will fall by the wayside. But Quanah's gotten us started."
"And you brought him to that," Tarrant said.
"Well, I worked against the prophets. I used what influence I had toward getting peace into the minds of the people. And you, from your side, kept your promise."
Tarrant grinned crookedly. "It had cost. You couldn't simply buy politicians. You had to buy or push men who in their turn could strike deals with the grim incorruptibles. But Quanah did not go to jail or hang."
"I suspect you're too modest," Tarrant said. "Never mind. We've done our work. Maybe we've justified our long lives. I don't know. So you're ready to travel?"
Peregrino nodded.
"I can't do anything more here that others can't, whom I've helped train. And I have been on this reservation more than a quarter century. Quanah's covered for me, kept me pretty much tucked in a corner, discouraged those who remember from talking to outsiders about me. But it isn't like the prairie. Folks are wondering. If any real word leaked to the newspapers, ah, that worries at an end. I leave him a letter and my blessing."
He looked out the window. It faced west. His hand lifted to his lips the brew of a people who themselves were once barbarians, southward raiding, northward retreating in war after war for their freedom. He said, "It's time for me to start over."
Chapter 15. Coming Together. 1. Rain roared. It washed away heat and grime, turned the air into flying, stinging gray. When lightning flashed, the hue became brief mercury, while thunder trampled down noise of motors, horns, water spurting from wheels. One bolt stabbed the new Empire State Building, but dissolved in the steel web under the masonry. Though the hour was early afternoon, headlights glimmered on cars and buses. Even midtown, pedestrians became few, trudging hunched beneath umbrellas or dodging from marquee to warning. Taxis were not to be had. Uptown, Loras McCandall's street lay altogether bare. Ordinarily it bore life enough, and after dark bustled and glittered. Several nightclubs had sprung up among the neighborhood's modest tenements, small shops, and this old mansion she had renovated. Hard times or no, white folks still came to Harlem for jazz, dance, comedy, a little freedom from care such as they told each other Negroes were born to. Just now everybody was inside, waiting out the weather. She glanced at the clock and beckoned to one of the maids. "Listen well, Cindy," she said. "You haven't been long in service, and something very important will happen today. I don't want you making mistakes."
"Yes, Mama Lo."
Awe shivered in the girl's voice. Loras shook her head. "That, for instance.
I have told you before I am only Mama Lo at holy times. Sorry, ma'am.
Tears blurred sight of the woman who stood before the girl, a woman who looked young and yet somehow old as time. Tall, slim, in a maroon dress of quiet elegance, a silver snake bracelet on her left wrist, and at her throat a golden pendant whose intertwined circle and triangle surrounded a ruby. Too dark to be called high yellow, but with narrow face, arched nose, hair straight and stiff.
I keeps forgettin'.
Laras smiled and reached to pat the maid's hand.
Don't be afraid, dear.
Her voice, which could be a trumpet, sang like a violin. You're young, with much to learn. Mainly, I want you to understand that my visitor today is special. That's why no men will be around except Joseph, and he's to stay with the car. You will help in the kitchen. Don't leave it. No, there is nothing wrong with the way you serve at table, and you're prettier than Conchita. But she ranks higher. Rank must be earned, by service as well as faith and study. Your time will come, I'm sure. Mainly, Cindy, you are to keep silence. You may not speak a single word to anybody, ever, about who my guest was, or anything else you might happen to see or hear. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am.
Good. Now be off with you, child. Oh, and do work harder on your English. You'll never get anywhere in the world unless you sound educated. Are educated. Master Thomas tells me you aren't doing so well at arithmetic either. If you need extra help, ask him for it. Teaching isn't just his job. It's his calling.
Yes, ma'am.
Laras inclined her head and half-closed her big eyes as if listening. Your good angel hovers near, she said. Go in peace. The girl trotted off, pert in her starched uniform, radiant in her sudden joy. Alone, Laras prowled about, picked up objects, fiddled with them, put them down again. She had made this room Victorian. Oak wainscots, heavy furniture, thick carpet and drapes, glass-fronted cabinets for carefully chosen curios, a shelf of books still more select, on top of which rested the white bust of a man who had been black. Electric bulbs in a glass chandelier were dim. Rain's twilight crowded close. The effect was impressive without being overly strange. When, from a bow window, she saw the car she had dispatched arrive at the curb, she set restlessness aside and straightened. Most would depend on what impression she herself made. The chauffeur got out, unfolded a large umbrella, came around to the right side and opened the rear door. He escorted his passenger to the porch where he rang the bell for her. Laras didn't see that, but she heard and knew. She likewise knew of the two maids who received the visitor, took her coat, and guided her down the hall. As she entered the room, Laras went to meet her.
"Welcome, welcome,"
she said, and clasped both hands in hers. Clara Rosario's fingers responded only slightly, as did her mouth to the smile offered her. She seemed alien, her own finery a little too bright-colored. Though her hair was marcelled midnight, skin tawny, lips full, she was of white race, hazel-eyed, straight-nosed, wide across the cheekbones. Laras stood 3 inches higher. Nonetheless, Clara carried herself boldly, as well she might, given a figure like hers.
"Thank you," she said with a staccato accent, glancing about. "Quite a place you got here."
"We'll be private in the sanctum," said Laras. "It has a liquor cabinet. Or would you prefer tea or coffee? I'll order it brought."
"Ah, thanks, but I could use a drink right now,"
Clara laughed nervously.
"You can stay for dinner, can't you? I promise you a cordon bleu meal. By then we should have completed our business, and be able to relax and enjoy it."
"Well, not too late. They expect me there, you know. I jolly them along, and could be trouble, too, for me to head off. Men are kind of on edge these days, wondering what's going to go wrong next, you know.
Besides, we don't want anybody wondering what you're up to," Laras agreed.
"Don't worry. I'll send you back in plenty of time." She took Clara's arm. "This way, please." When the door had shut behind them, Clara stood a while, tensed. Between curtained windows, the smaller room was wholly foreign. Straw mats covered the floor, leopard pelts, the curiously shaped chairs. Two African masks dominated one wall. On a shelf between them rested a human skull. Opposite stretched an 8-foot python skin. At the farther end stood a marble altar. Upon its red-bordered white cloth were a knife, a crystal bowl full of water, and a bronze candlestick with 7 twisty branches. Lighting was from a single, heavily shaded lamp on a table beside silver boxes for cigarettes and matches, and an incense holder whose smoke turned breath pungent. Almost lost in their everydayness were the cabinet and console radio that flanked the entrance, or the coffee table, which near the middle held glasses, ice buckets, seltzer, carafe, ashtrays, small dishes of delicacies. "Don't be alarmed," said Loras. "You must have seen magicians' lairs in the past." Clara nodded. "A few times," she gulped. "You mean you—" "Well, yes and no. These things aren't for use. They're meant to convey sacredness, power, mystery. Also," Loras added matter-of-factly, "nobody would dare open that door without my leave, under any circumstances whatsoever. We can talk in perfect safety." Clara rallied. She would not have endured through her centuries without ample courage, and her hostess offered nothing but friendship, of a sort, and provided it be possible. "I guess we've gone mighty different ways, you and me. Time we bring them together. Would you like some music? I can get 2 good stations." "No, let's just talk," Clara grimaced. "I don't need music all the time, you know. I run a high-class house." "Poor dear." Much sorrow was in the gentleness. "You don't have it so easy, do you? Have you ever?" Clara lifted her head. "I get by. How about that drink?" She chose a strong bourbon and branch, together with a cigarette, and settled onto the sofa before the table. Loras poured a glass of Bordeaux and sat down on a chair across from her. For a space there was silence, apart from the dulled noise of the rainstorm. Then Clara said, half defiantly, "Well, what about it? What are we going to talk about?" "Suppose you start," Loras answered, her words continuing soft. "Whatever you want. This is just the first of our real meetings. We'll need many more. We have everything to learn about each other, and decide, and finally do." Clara drew breath. "Okay," she said fast. "How did you find me? When you showed up at my apartment and told me you're immortal, too?" It had not brought on hysteria, but Loras had soon realized she'd better go. Afterward, it had been a matter of 3 careful telephone conversations until now. "I thought at first you were crazy, you know? But you didn't act it. And how could a crazy person have found out? Later I wondered if you wanted to blackmail me, but that didn't make sense either. Only, all right. How do you know what I am, and how can I know you really are what you claim?" She raised her glass in a jerky motion and drank deep. "I don't want to offend you, but, well, I've got to be more sure." "Naturally you're cautious," Loras said. "Do you think I'm not? We've both had to be, or die. But look around you. Would something like this belong to any criminal such as you ever knew?" No. Unless the prophet of a cult. But I never heard of you, and I would have, as rich as you must be. I'm not, nor is the organization I lead. It does require me to maintain the appearance of solidity. As to your questions, though." Loras sipped of her wine. Her voice grew slow, almost dreamy. "I don't know when I was born. If any record was made, I couldn't tell where to find it, and probably it's long lost. Who cared about a pickaninny slave? But from what I remember, and what I deduced after I began to study, I must be about 200 years old. That isn't much, set against your age. 1400, did you say? But of course I wondered, more and more desperately, whether I was quite alone in the world or not. Any others like me must be hiding the fact like me. Men can go into a variety of occupations, lives. Women have fewer opportunities. When at last I had the means to search, it made sense to begin with the trade that a woman might very well, even most likely, be forced into. "Whoredom," said Clara starkly. "I told you before I pass no judgments. We do what we must to survive. One such as you could have left a trail often broken, but perhaps possible to follow, given time and patience. After all, she wouldn't expect anybody would think to try. Newspaper files, police and court records, tax rolls and other registers where prostitution had been legal, old photographs, things like that, gathered, sifted, compared. Some of my agents have been private detectives. Some have been followers of mine. None knows why I wanted this information. Slowly, out of countless fragments, a few parts fitted together, it seemed there had been a woman who did well in Chicago back in the 90s, till she got into some kind of trouble, curiously similar to one in New York later, in New Orleans later still, again in New York. Clara made a slicing gesture. "Never mind," she snapped. "I get the idea. I should have remembered, in fact. It happened before." "What?" "Back in Constantinopolis, Istanbul. Oh, Lord, 900 years ago it must have been. A man tracked me down pretty much the same way." Ross started to rise, sank back, leaned forward. "Another immortal," she cried. "A man? What became of him?" "I don't know," belligerently. "I wasn't glad to be found then, and I'm not sure I am now. You are a woman. I guess that makes a difference, but you've got to convince me, you know." "A man," Loras whispered. "Who was he? What was he like?" "Two. He had a partner. They were traders out of Russia. I didn't want to go off with them, so I shook them and never heard anything since. Probably they're dead. Let's not talk about it yet, okay?" The rain silence descended. "What a horror of a life you have had," Loras finally said. Clara grinned on the left side of her mouth. "Oh, I'm tough. Between the times I work, when I live easy on what I've earned and saved, or sometimes, yeah, I've married money. It's good enough that I want to keep going." "I should think. You told me you've mostly been a madam since you came to America. Isn't that better than it used to be for you?" "Not always."
2.
She hated sleeping where she worked. In Chicago, she had an apartment 5 blocks away. Usually she could go home about 2 or 3 a.m., and the afternoons were her own. Then business was slack enough for Sadie to manage. She'd go shopping downtown, or enjoy the sunshine and flowers in Jackson Park, or visit one of the museums built after the Columbian Exposition, or ride a trolley out into the countryside, all sorts of things, maybe with a couple of the girls, maybe by herself. But always ladylike. Gas lamps flared, pavement stretched ash gray, empty as the moon. Lightly though she walked, her footfall sounded loud in her ears. The two men who came out of an alley were like more shadows until they fell in on either side of her. She choked down a gasp. Fear chilled and keened. He on the right was a hulk, bristle-chinned and smelly. He on the left was hardly more than a boy. He had no color in his face except for the pus yellow the lamps gave it, and from time to time he giggled.
"Hello, Mrs. Ross," the big man said. His voice was gritty. "Nice evening, ain't it?"
"Fool," she raged at herself. "Fool! I should have been careful. I should have spent what a bodyguard would cost, but no, I couldn't be bothered. I had to save every cent toward my next years of freedom." In a way that was ancient with her, she killed the fear. She couldn't afford it.
"I don't know you," she said. "Let me be." "We know you. Mr. Santoni, he showed us on the street when you was passing by. He asked us we should have a little talk with you." "Go, before I call a policeman."
The boy tittered.
"Shut up, Lou," said the big man. "You get too impatient."
To her.
"Now don't be like that, Mrs. Ross. All we want to do is talk with you a while. You just come along quiet."
"I'll talk to your boss, Mr. Santoni. I'll speak to him again if he insists."
"By time. Later today, yes." "Oh, no. Not so soon. He says you've been real unreasonable."
"He wants to add my business to his string. He wants to end every independent house in the city. We're to do his will and pay him his tribute. Christ, before it's too late, send us a man with a sawed-up shotgun. It was already too late for her.
He wants Lou and me should have a little talk with you first. He can't waste no more of his time arguing. You got me? Just come along quiet now, and you'll be all right. Lou, put that goddamn shiv back.
She tried to run. A long arm snapped her to a halt. The way they pinioned her was effective. Further resistance could have led to a dislocated shoulder. Around the next corner waited a cabriolet and driver. The horse hadn't far to go before it reached a certain building. Several times the big man must restrain the boy. Afterward, he would sponge her, speak soothingly, give her a smoke before they resumed. Drawing on past experience, she avoided damage that would be permanent, on her if not on a mortal. They actually let her out of the cab in front of a doctor's house. The hospital staff were amazed at how fast she healed, quite without marks. While they did not interrogate her, they understood more or less what had happened, and expected it would be a very meek, obliging, frequently smiling person who left them. Well, a body so extraordinary might generate a personality equally resilient. Just the same, Carlotta Ross cut her losses, sold whatever she could, and dropped from sight. She had never heard of the rival who later bushwhacked Santoni. She seldom bothered taking revenge. Time did that for her, eventually. She was content to start over elsewhere. Forewarned. 3. I get along, though. I'm used to the life. Pretty good at it, in fact. Clara laughed. By now, I'd better be, huh? Do you loathe all men? Loras asked.
Don't pity me.
Sorry, you mean well. I shouldn't have flared up. No, I've met some that I guess were decent. Not usually in my line of work, though, and not for me. I don't have to take them on any more myself. Just take their money. I couldn't have anybody for real anyway. Can I? Can you? Not forever, obviously. Unless someday we find others of our kind. Loras saw the expression before her. Others we like. Mind if I have a refill of this drink? I'll help myself. Clara did, and took a cigarette from her purse. Meanwhile, she asked, no longer aggressive, almost shy. What about you, Loras? How do you feel? You were a slave once, you've said. That must have been as bad as anything I ever knew. Maybe worse. Christ knows how many slaves I've seen in my life. Sometimes it was very bad. Other times it was, oh, comfortable, but never free. At last I ran away. White people who were against slavery got me to Canada. There I found work as a housemaid. Clara studied Loras before murmuring, You don't talk or behave like a servant. I changed. My employers helped me. The Dufours, they were, kindly, mildly prosperous, in Montreal. When they saw I wanted to better myself, they arranged schooling for me, after working hours. And servants worked long hours in those days, so it took years, but I'll always be grateful to the Dufour family. I learned correct English, reading, writing, arithmetic. On my own, consorting with habitants, I picked up French of a sort. I turned into quite a bookworm as far as circumstances allowed. They gave me a patchwork education, but as the years went on, I gradually filled many of the gaps in it. First, I had to master memory. I was finding it harder and harder to pull whatever I wanted out of such a ragbag of recollections. It was becoming hard to think. I had to do something. You faced the same problem, I dare say. Clara nodded. Awful for maybe 50 years. I don't know what I did or how. Can't recall much, and everything's jumbled. Might have gotten into real trouble and died, except... Okay. I fell into the hands of a pimp. He, and later his son, they did my thinking for me. They weren't bad guys by their lights, and of course, my not growing old made me special, maybe magical. So they didn't dare abuse me, by the standards of the, 8th century Near East, it must have been. I think they never let on to anybody else, but moved me to a different city every few years. Meanwhile, somehow, bit by bit, I got myself sorted out, and when the sun died, I felt ready to strike off on my own again. I wonder if most immortals aren't that lucky. Somebody insane or witless wouldn't last long without a protector most times and places, would she? I've thought that myself. I was luckier still. By the early 20th century, we had a science of psychology. Crude, largely guesswork. But the idea that the mind can be understood and fixed makes a huge difference. I found auto-hypnosis did wonders. We'll talk about this later. Oh, we have so much to talk about. I guess you never got too badly confused then. No, I kept control throughout. Of course, I moved around. It hurt to leave the Dufours, but people were wondering why I didn't age like them. Also, more and more, I wanted independence, true independence. I went from job to job, acquired skills, saved my money. In 1900, I moved back to the States. There, a colored person was less conspicuous, and here in New York, you can go as unnoticed as you care to. I opened a small cafe. It did well. I am a good cook, and in time, I was able to start a larger place with entertainment. The war boomed business. Afterward, Prohibition made profits larger yet. White customers. I kept another, less fancy den for blacks. One of my white regulars became a friend. At City Hall, he saw to it that I didn't pay off exorbitantly or have to worry about the mob muscling in. Clara considered her surroundings. "You didn't buy this with the proceeds from two speakeasies," she said. Laras smiled. "Shrewd, aren't you?" "Well, the truth is that presently I took up with a pretty big-time rum-runner. White, but..." 4. Donald O'Brien loved wind and water. At home he filled shelves with books about sailing ships, hung pictures of them on the walls, built models of them whose exquisite details seemed impossible for such large hands. Besides, the power cruiser he used in his business, he kept a sloop on Long Island Sound. When he started taking his black housekeeper on day trips, she went unchallenged by members of the yacht club. Everybody liked Don, but nobody who was smart messed with him. Heeled over on a broad reach, the boat rushed through swoosh and sparkle. Gulls soared white above the wake, into which he had merrily cast scraps from lunch. When he ran before the wind, its booming was hushed to a cradle song, and the air grew almost snug so that you caught the live salt smell of it. Reaching, a steersman must be careful. Don had secured the boom against an accidental jibe, but control remained tricky. He managed without effort. His body belonged where he was. His being had turned elsewhere. Between watch cap and pea jacket, the snub-nosed face had lost its earlier cheerfulness. "Why won't you marry me?" he pleaded. "I want to make an honest woman of you. Really, I do." "This is honest enough for me," she laughed. "Flora, I love you. It's not only that you're grand in bed, though you are. It's your soul. You're brave and dear and 1,000 times more bright than me. It's proud I'd be to have you bear my children." Humor died. She shook her head. "We're too different." "Was the Queen of Sheba too different from King Solomon?" "In this country she would be." "Is it the law you fret about? Listen, not every state forbids marriage between the races, and the rest have to respect it once it's happened where it's allowed. That's in the Constitution." "The same Constitution that says a man can't take a glass of beer after a hot day's work," she thought. "No, it's what we have to live with. Hatred, isolation from both your people and mine. I couldn't do that to our children." "Not everywhere," he argued. "Listen, you've heard me before, but listen. I won't keep my trade forever. In a few more years, I'll have more money piled together than we could spend in 100. Because I am really a careful, saving man in spite of liking a good time. I'll take you to Ireland, to France. You always wanted to see France, you said. And what I saw made me want to go back, during the war though it was. We can settle down wherever we like, in some sweet country where they don't care what the color of our skins may be, only the color of our hearts." "Wait till then. and we'll talk about this. Maybe by then I can bring myself to it, to seeing time eat him hollow. Maybe I'll be sure by then that he won't grow bitter when I tell him, because I can never deceive him, not in any way that matters, and will even be glad to have me there in my strength, holding his hand as he lies on his deathbed.
No, now. We can keep it secret if you want.
She stared across the dancing waves. I can't do that either, darling. Please don't ask me to. He frowned.
Is it you fear being the wife of a jailbird? I swear to God they'll never take me alive. Not that I expect they'll catch me at all.
She looked back at him. A lock of hair curled brown from beneath the cap and fluttered across his brow. How like a boy he seemed. A small boy full of love and earnestness. She remembered sons she had born and buried. What difference would it make whether a justice of the peace mumbled a few words over us, if we aren't free to stand together in sight of everybody?
I want to give you my vows.
You have given them, dearest. I could weep for the joy of that.
Well, there is this, too, he said, rougher-toned. I don't plan on dying, but we never know, and I want to make sure I leave you provided for. Won't you give my heart that ease?
I don't need an inheritance. Thank you, thank you. But I don't, she grimaced.
Nor do I want more to do with lawyers and the government than I can possibly help.
So. He gnawed his lip for a minute.
Well, I can understand that.
All right. His smile burst forth like the sun between clouds. Not that I'm giving up on making you Mrs. O'Brien, mind you. I'll wear you down, I will. Meanwhile, however, I'll make arrangements. I don't trust bankers much anyway, and this is a profitable time to liquidate my real estate holdings. We'll put it in gold, and you'll know where the hoard is.
End of side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.